Welcome to God and Country Biblical Exposition. Last week, YouTube took down my program about the Democrat voting right bill. They said it violated their policy about claiming election fraud. They must have content moderators watching my entire video, most likely because I'm already on their naughty list. But that really pushed my hot button because I never even got into the subject of any cheating in the 2020 election. The only thing I mentioned was that Dinesh D'Souza is coming out with a documentary next month called 2,000 Mules, which just shares evidence from state investigators captured on video and phone records of political operators stuffing ballot boxes. Now, surely YouTube is not censoring even the mention of legitimate documentaries. See, the issue with these social media platforms is that it's no longer about whether or not you're telling the truth, but what might be the outcome of your free speech. For example, in regard to COVID policy, it's not about whether you're telling the truth. It's about whether one is creating vaccine hesitancy. And this is becoming the same mindset when it comes to elections. It's not about whether you're telling the truth. It's about whether or not you're undermining the one who is declared to be the winner of a certain party. And you can understand how dangerous this philosophy is, this kind of censorship. It's the philosophy we see in the old Soviet Union, among the Chaikoms in North Korea, in Nazi Germany. Truth is not the criteria. What matters is the narrative chosen by those who are in power. The governor of Washington State, Jay Inslee, a Democrat, of course, is pushing a new law that makes it illegal to criticize election results. I mean, such a law would secure permanent protection for those who cheat in an election. And it would legalize the persecution of political opponents by those in power. So what is Jay Inslee thinking? Well, not about constitutional rights of free speech, but he has a mindset of authoritarianism. He has got the mindset of a despot. I don't even understand how the voters in Washington State could even vote for that man. Well, the big surprise was that after filing an appeal with YouTube, after 2 days, they restored my video and they took me off suspension. So someone there has some common sense. Well, in this week's program, I'd like to discuss a very important story that's not being discussed in the media about the January 6th protesters in Washington, D.C., being held without bail, without trial, being called domestic terrorists for participating in the January 6th rally. These are political prisoners in the United States. And in regard to those who are in prison, the Bible tells us in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 3, remember the prisoners as those in prison with them, and those who are ill-treated, since you yourselves are also in the body. Now, the phrase, you are also in the body, is a call to solidarity. Since we also know what it's like to be cold and hungry and lonely in our earthly experience in these fleshly bodies, we should also understand what these men are going through. Even more convicting is Jesus' words in Matthew 25, I was in prison and you visited me. That's why today's program is about this story. You know, we need to get the word out. The early church father Tertullian said, if there happens to be any Christian in the mines, banished to the islands, or shut up in prisons, the Christians become carriers of their confession. In other words, other Christians need to speak up for these bound prisoners. We must become their voice. We must let their situation be known to the public. Especially since the news media, because of leftist ideology, is not reporting on the story. You know, we know that if those in prison were protesters for some leftist cause, the media would be reporting on these imprisonments every night. So what was the January 6th rally all about? When I was there, I was interviewed by a New York Times reporter. I didn't give her my name. And I explained to her that these people aren't here to overturn the election. What these people want is an investigation before the election is certified. The courts would not touch this issue because they did not want to interfere with an election that was the responsibility of legislators. And the legislators in these blue states didn't want to touch this because their candidate won. So the normal checks and balances in government weren't working. And this is why the fourth branch of government, the people themselves, showed up in mass. One of the largest rallies in America's history. And this was the first time this reporter heard this. She was completely unaware of all the arguments and the evidence because she was living in a leftist media bubble. What we now have been hearing in the media about these people being violent extremists who are plotting an insurrection against the government is a false leftist slant on the story. These January 6th participants were loyal constitutional patriots, the best citizens we have in America. Only 309 individuals out of a 500,000 in attendance walked into the Capitol building. And most of them walked in because the police removed the barriers and some of the officers were actually caught on camera waving protesters to come in. And then there were Antifa plants and government plants in the crowd that clearly helped to incite the break-in. Just one example, John Sullivan, a leftist activist, feigned being a Trump supporter and helped break into the Capitol. But among the Trump supporters who entered, there were no weapons, there were no fires, no one destroyed anything in the rotunda, there were no plans for an insurrection, there were no plans to kidnap or harm U.S. senators. Here's a fact, not one person arrested in conjunction with the January 6th rally has been charged with sedition or insurrection. Because there's no case for it. Yet every night in the news, media personalities keep dropping the term insurrection to create a preferred narrative. If it weren't for the political witch hunt reaction by the Democrats, the response would have been a small fine, a slap on the wrist, like what takes place at all other protests in America. The breaking of windows and doors, of course, may have been by stupid, overenthusiastic protesters, but definitely there were some opposition plants in the crowd. Not all, but some. And the Capitol Police bear some responsibility for much of the violence. The police shot rubber bullets, flashbangs, tear gas at people standing at the gates, and they beat people over the head with batons. And the people had to push back against the police just to protect themselves. The police murdered five people that day with their brutality. Tyler Hansen, newsletter at Substack. Benjamin Phillips, hit by a concussion grenade and died. Kevin Greeson, also killed by a concussion grenade, randomly thrown into the crowd by the Capitol Police. Roseanne Boylan, beat to death with a baton by a female Capitol Police officer. The media reported that she died of a drug overdose. And then Ashley Babbitt, shot to death by a Capitol Police officer, and we all know about this case. The media was willing to talk about her case because it appeared as if she was trying to climb through a barricaded door. But it still was clearly excessive force on the part of that officer. His life was not being threatened by this 110-pound woman. Finally, there was the death of Officer Brian Sicknick. Tyler Hansen writes the following. The death of Officer Brian Sicknick was contorted by the media and the political establishment to claim him as their fallen martyr. When the truth is told, citizens will see that Officer Sicknick is the people's hero. The controversy and stories surrounding his death and its origins will help more than any other evidence in proving a conspiracy to hide the truth. The government and media outlets use this deception to shift blame for Sicknick's death onto innocent protesters and to launch an official impeachment proceeding against President Trump. They know, and have always known, the entire spin of Sicknick's death is a big lie. Mainstream media set the pace for Sicknick's story based on information the government told them to use. The original narrative was that Sicknick was bludgeoned to death. They said he was violently murdered by a protester with a fire extinguisher. But that is criminally inaccurate. Look at the following documents to see how the media and government play the shell game with the American people and keep changing their story. Well, the truth is, Sicknick died 8 hours after the protest from a stroke. There were no chemicals or wounds on his body. Now, in addition to those who died that day, there are hundreds of others who were injured by Capitol Police officers. And not one Capitol Police officer has been investigated, except in the case of Ashley Babbitt. And he was quickly exonerated by the Capitol Police themselves. That's not exactly an unbiased investigation. The Capitol Police, who are responsible, are simply clearing one of their own. Well, in addition to the violence done by the Capitol Police that day, the FBI sent out SWAT teams to arrest people who were there at that rally. And there were hundreds of reports in alternative media about how these agents broke all legal protocol in arresting these suspects. The Hollywood actor Nick Searcy put out a documentary interviewing some of these cases. The documentary is called Capital Punishment. That's capital with an O, not an A. In the documentary, there is the testimony of two grandmothers, Laureen and Maureen. They were arrested and charged with federal trespassing. And their testimony was that the guards waved them to go in, and they wanted to go in and see what the rotunda looked like. They even asked a Capitol Police officer if he was upset with them being there, and he shook his head no. 10 officers were standing there and didn't say a word. They didn't think they were doing anything wrong because the police said nothing. Now, lawfully, if the police said nothing, these women shouldn't be charged, because the Capitol is usually open for visitors during those hours. In the documentary, there was the testimony of Derek and Tony, two Christian friends who went to Washington with medical gear to attend the rally and to give aid. They were trying to save the lives of people hit with batons and bullets and tear gas. They didn't even enter the Capitol building. But a few weeks later, SWAT teams showed up at their houses and smashed in their doors. They handcuffed their wives and children, pointed high-powered rifles at them and their families. They threw flashbangs on their living room floor, and the FBI didn't even show a warrant. Now, the FBI could have simply called these men to come into the office, or they could have sent a couple of officers, but instead they come with a Humvee with an officer mounted on top with a machine gun. So what seems to be happening is that the current Biden administration put together a team of Democrat, Trump-hating FBI agents and sent them out to demonize and intimidate political opponents, to give a message to America that conservatives shouldn't protest. So it's like we're not in America anymore. This is communist Soviet Union Chi-Com behavior. But as America becomes more secular, we're going to become like these communist regimes. This behavior is going to become commonplace. Now, in these DC jails, those arrested are subject to Democrat guards who are saying F Trump. The warden of the DC jail is a radical Trump-hating leftist. And these government employees are enjoying the power of persecuting their political opponents. The reason these January 6th detainees are being denied bail is because the powers that be considered their actions to be heinous and seditious. And therefore, they're deemed dangerous criminals. If you're a dangerous criminal, the law says you don't get bail. But in this case, how dangerous you think these January 6th protesters are is a function of your political beliefs. A conservative or a neutral judge wouldn't consider these people dangerous. But if you're a Democrat ideologue, these are the worst people in the world. They're an existential threat to American democracy. Back in July, the Democrats put together a January 6th commission to look into what happened on that day. Just like the Russian collusion investigation, they wanted to keep the story in the news. They wanted to twist the story so that they could use it against the right. When the commission was formed, the Republican leader of the House, McCarthy, put forth five Republicans to be on the committee. But the Democrats rejected all five because they were the smart conservative Republicans who they knew would push back against the Democrat narrative that was trying to be created by this committee. So the Republicans then refused to participate altogether. But the Democrats were able to find two leftist Republicans to serve on that committee, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. Two leftist Republicans and seven Democrats. So how fair is that? Well, last week, the Republican National Committee had enough with Cheney and Kinzinger and censored them for going along with the Democrat false narrative. And the RNC put out this statement. Representatives Cheney and Kinzinger are participating in a Democrat-led persecution of ordinary citizens engaged in legitimate political discourse. See the difference? Constitutional patriots see the rally as legitimate political discourse in defending democracy. The Democrats are trying to frame the rally as an insurrection. Well, of course, the Democrats were all upset that the Republicans called the rally legitimate political discourse. But of course, the RNC wasn't talking about the break-in. They were referring to the entire day itself, which the Democrats are characterizing as an insurrection. The Republican head of the Senate, McConnell, disagreed with the RNC statement, and he even agreed with the Democrats and called January 6th an insurrection. But McConnell is often a rhino, Republican in name only. Now, as far as the J6 commission is concerned, it's of course not looking into the misbehavior of the Capitol Police, the unlawful arrests and tactics, the unlawful imprisonment. Instead, they're going after and demonizing anyone who had anything to do with the rally. It's political theater for the leftist news to report on every night. So there's a lot to be said about the injustices taking place against these J6 prisoners. I have hundreds of articles. There are hundreds of teachable issues here. But let me just read a letter from one prisoner. Alan Fisher, an Air Force vet. By the way, he never even entered into the Capitol building. He writes this. I'm an honorably discharged, decorated United States Air Force veteran, having coordinated and supervised missions, including transporting President Obama via Marine One and multiple U.S. Secret Service and SEAL Team 6 movements, both here in the United States and around the world. While I cannot comment at this time about any details of my ongoing case as a J6 defendant on the advice of counsel, I do wish to take this opportunity to shed light on the police brutality I witnessed at the hands of Capitol Police on January 6, 2021. Where I was in attendance of a peaceful rally in Washington, D.C., to have my voice heard and to help ensure the safety of fellow vulnerable protesters, of which included crowds of mothers, grandmothers, and children. This brutality included the use of both lethal and non-lethal force against patriotic, flag-waving Americans. Within the first minutes of the protest, we found ourselves under the assault of a barrage of flashbang grenades, rubber bullets, K-47 chemical weapons and other potentially deadly or dangerous projectiles via what was assumed to be the hands of Capitol Police. This peaceful attempt to exercise First Amendment rights quickly transformed into what resembled war zones I had seen as a combat veteran. Had a service member, such as myself, used such force against innocent groups of civilians in any other part of the world, they would have been duly court-martialed and prosecuted for violations of the Geneva Convention. I wish to continue bearing witness to the events on that fateful day, including violent beatings and the witnessing of multiple murders, including one man pushed off a wall to his death and a female victim whose body I saw beaten until lifeless, both by what appeared to be Capitol Police officers. I stood alongside a fellow lawful protester when a rubber bullet penetrated and became lodged in his cheek, rendering him incapacitated and suffering significant blood loss. As a trained DOD combat casualty care instructor, I instinctively began to triage this unprovoked attack. Unfortunately, this would not be the only injured protester who would require my assistance that day. Let me state for the record that I was there on January 6th in attendance of this peaceful protest, not only to have my voice heard, but to ensure the safety and prevent injury of fellow peaceful protesters by nefarious actors such as the violent communist terrorist group Antifa, who prey on, assault, and murder law-abiding citizens for attempting to exercise their God-given right to freedom of speech and assembly. The violence I witnessed that day has been largely ignored by the mainstream media and federal government investigators who selectively, for political gain, frame events of that day as an insurrection rather than the unwarranted tragedy it was. Everything alleged in the statement can be confirmed without question by countless hours of video evidence in possession of the aforementioned government prosecutors and federal investigators. I, along with hundreds of protesters from that day, are currently the victims of both a weaponized federal justice system and corresponding biased media coverage. As non-convicted political prisoners, we are being denied basic constitutional rights, such as detention without bond, unnecessary delays in court hearings, secured access to legal counsel, and protection from cruel and unusual inhumane punishment. It's my goal to have my voice assist in securing justice for patriots from J6, in addition to helping guarantee the constitutional rights of peaceful assembly in the future. Demand action from your representative. Free our political prisoners. May God bless America. Senior Airman AJ Fisher. Some final points. Notice what makes America America. Is America has First Amendment rights of speech, rights of assembly, and the right to petition our government in redress of grievances. And the main job of police, the main emphasis, is to protect that right, not to indiscriminately fire into the crowd. Second, know that these Capitol Police are trying to make plea deals with these defendants because they don't want these cases to come to trial. Because if they come before a jury, evidence of police brutality is going to come out. Third, I will bet anyone $100, and I'm not a betting man, so I'm speaking facetiously, that if this is investigated, the Capitol Police, who abused the protesters on January 6th, were all Democrats. And the Capitol Police, who waved people to come on in, were mostly conservative Republicans. The whole thing is a matter of political partisanship and perspective. That's really what's going on here. But the January 6th Commission will not dare discuss that fact because they're too partisan. So that was all by way of introduction. What's the biblical lesson here? When corrupt, unprincipled politicians rule, there will be no justice. Like in these communist countries, law enforcement is used against political opponents. Proverbs chapter 29, verse 2. When the righteous increase, the people rejoice, but when a wicked man rules, people groan. Proverbs 28:12. When the righteous triumph, there is great glory, but when wicked men rise, men hide themselves. When bullies rule, when good people are persecuted, it brings forth a righteous indignation among God's people. Reading these accounts makes my blood boil. We would all love to see the swift justice of God. And so that's what I'd like to address. What God's doing in all this, where is the God of justice? If a SWAT team arrests you, if you're sitting in prison for speaking the truth, you really start asking that question. Remember the biblical account of the prophet Elijah's arrest? We often wonder why it's not like that today. When Ahaziah, the king of Israel, tried to arrest Elijah, fire came down from heaven and consumed the arresting officers. 1 Kings chapter 1, the prophet Elijah announces to some of the king's men that King Ahaziah is going to die of a disease. So Ahaziah now wants Elijah brought in, most likely because in a land where there's no free speech, kings don't appreciate someone announcing that the king's going to die. So the king sends 50 troops to arrest Elijah, more than enough to do the job, but the king wanted to show his power over dissenters. So 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 9, then the king sent to him a captain of 50 with his 50, and he went up to him, and behold, he, the prophet Elijah, was sitting on the top of the hill. And he said to him, O man of God, the king says, come down. Elijah replied to the captain of 50, if I'm a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. Then fire came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Now, the title man of God is not being used as a title of respect. It was just a common title. And Elijah said, if I am who you say I am, then may the following judgment come to pass. Now, you think at this point that the king would realize his place and be humble, but 2 Kings 1:11, so he, King Ahaziah, sent to him another captain of 50 with his 50. And he said to him, O man of God, thus saith the king, come down quickly. Elijah replied to them, if I'm a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. Then the fire of God came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Well, the second captain is more demanding, saying, come down immediately. After this, the king sends a third group, but this time, even though the king is persisting in his arrogance, this captain realizes he better come with some humility, some respect, some pleading for mercy. Verse 13, so again he sent a captain of a third 50 with his 50. When the captain of the 50 went up, he came and bowed down on his knee before Elijah. And he begged him and said to him, O man of God, please let my life and the life of these 50 servants of yours be precious in your sight. Behold, fire came down from heaven and consumed the first two captains of 50 with their 50, but now let my life be precious in your sight. The angel of the Lord said to Elijah, go down with him, do not be afraid of him. So he arose and went down with him to the king. So in this third instance, we see the mercy of God being extended even under the Old Testament covenant of law. So if only we could do the same when rogue operators from the government come to arrest us. Well, maybe not death, but temporary blindness. Like the Apostle Paul brought down upon Elymais the magician in Acts chapter 13. Because of his error, God cursed him with blindness for a period of time. That's not for the purpose of being vindictive, but that the ungodly would know that there is a God in heaven who judges injustice. Imagine what kind of world we would have if Christians could call down fire from heaven upon evil people. Imagine how much evil would be stopped in the world. Not that every Christian would have the authority to do this, because probably few Christians would use it rightly, but at least that authority being given to mature Christians. But that doesn't happen. So there are a number of things going on here in Elijah's situation that need some explanation. First, there's the Romans 13 issue. Every person is to be subject to the governing authorities. And 1 Peter 2:13, submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him. However, this does not mean that the king is always right in what he does. And in such cases of wrongdoing, it's incumbent upon God's people to resist. Not to resist with physical weapons, but to resist with spiritual weapons. By speaking the truth, by rebuking, by even praying imprecatory prayers. Elijah wasn't seeking personal revenge. He was defending the truth and the honor of God. And the king needed to know that there were limits to his earthly authority. And notice Elijah didn't take matters into his own hands. God did the judging. But the point is still this. At that time, God defended his people from persecutors by consuming the enemy with fire. And the question is, why is this not normative? Why couldn't the Christians call down fire upon the Romans who slew them in the arena in the first century? Why can't Christians in China call down fire from heaven when the secret police come to arrest them for holding worship services? And why can't Christians today call down fire from heaven when persecuted by government agencies? And this is not just an Old Testament versus a New Testament thing. Under the Old Covenant, Jeremiah was put in prison. Isaiah was sawn in two. Even in the days of Elijah, Ahab and Jezebel put to death most of the prophets of Jehovah. 1 Kings 18:4. And no fire fell from heaven upon the persecutors. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 36. And others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were tempted, they were put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskin and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. You know, in Scripture, you get the sense that Elijah was one of the Jews' most admired heroes. Just like today, vigilante and superhero movies are quite popular because we dream of someone with miraculous power putting an end to injustice. We want there to be Elijahs. In Luke chapter 9, the Samaritans, out of hatred for the Jews, wouldn't let Jesus and his disciples pass through Samaria. Luke chapter 9, verse 54, when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them?" This was near the very place Elijah called down fire from heaven upon those who attempted to arrest him. And clearly the disciples had the example of Elijah in mind. But Jesus rebuked the disciples. Luke chapter 9, verse 55, but he turned and rebuked them and said, "You do not know of what kind of spirit you're of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." And they went to another village. Now, I'm well aware of the manuscript issues here surrounding this text, but we get the point. There are two possible explanations for Jesus' rebuke. First, either this was too harsh a penalty for such a denial, or second, this isn't the time for God's people to be calling down judgment upon sinners, even if it reaches the level worthy of capital punishment. We really have to nail down our theology in this because in Acts chapter 7, Stephen was arrested by the Sanhedrin and fire did not fall from heaven to save Stephen. In Acts chapter 12, Herod put James to death and there was no immediate protection from heaven. In Acts chapter 22, Paul is arrested and beaten, and Paul did not say, "If I'm a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you." And the main example of all is our Lord Jesus Christ. He was arrested in the garden, and Jesus did not call for his protection or for judgment. Jesus even stopped Peter from swinging the sword in self-defense. He said to Peter, "Put your sword back in its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?" Jesus was teaching them this, that God is perfectly capable of stopping all evil immediately, but God has some other purpose in mind, in the will of God. And in Jesus' case, that purpose was letting evil men expose what's truly in their hearts so they would crucify Jesus and so he could become the sinless sacrifice for our sins. Now, for the Christian, when deliverance doesn't come for us immediately, there is also a deeper spiritual purpose. Certainly, there must be a different purpose or a different administration of God between the work of God in the days of Elijah and the work of God in Jesus' day and in the days of the early church and even our own day. And to further confirm this, that there are different administrations of God, we have in Revelation chapter 11, where the prophecy is that in the apocalypse, in the future, we will see two prophets who will be able to call down fire from heaven. And this further fulfills the prophecy of Malachi chapter 4, verse 5. "Behold, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord." Someone has come in with the office and the administration of the prophet Elijah. Now, my guess is that these two prophets in the Revelation will have this authority, but they will rarely use it. They're not going to be calling down fire upon the Antichrist, just like Elijah didn't call down fire upon Ahab and Jezebel. The purpose is to give a sample warning of God's authority in a few cases. So, what are the purposes of God? If we don't understand the purposes of God, it's going to be very easy to be disappointed and discouraged by the fact that we don't receive supernatural deliverance immediately. I mean, how can we stand up against evil people if we don't have some special power? Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 1. "Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed and that they had no one to comfort them." In the Hebrew, no one to help them. "And on the side of the oppressor was power, but they had no one to help them." The answer to this question involves multiple truths. First, realize that those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, when they suffer unjustly, they win the culture in regard to moral authority. As Tertullian wrote, "The blood of the saints is the seed of the church." The more they persecute us, the more the church grows. The more they persecute us, the more the message is communicated that the state is evil. The state is showing itself to be evil and thereby undermining its own legitimacy with the people, something that the state cannot afford to lose. By persecuting the righteous, the state is hurting itself more than it's hurting those it persecutes. And this is why Paul would write that in his imprisonment, though it was not a righteous thing, God used it to grow and strengthen the church and to increase evangelism. Philippians chapter 1, verse 12, "I want you to know, brethren, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel, so that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the whole Praetorian Guard and to everyone else." Now, this is counterintuitive because we think we can get change and results by intimidation and violence. The squeaky wheel gets the oil. Politicians only seem to listen when we threaten them with pitchforks and lanterns. But when we have the power to judge our persecutors, we may gain some immediate justice, but we lose what we may call, for lack of a better term, moral authority. And throughout history, the persecuted righteous always won the hearts and minds of the people. Take 9/11, for example. Those Islamists who flew planes into those buildings did more to defeat Islam than any invasions by Western nations. Back in 2000, given all of the immorality in the West, Islam was looking quite appealing to the moral conservative crowd. Because while Western nations were abandoning the duty of the state to stop immorality, Islamic countries still believed that it was the responsibility of the state to impose some of God's natural law. For sure, it was the devil's legalism, but it was fooling a lot of Westerners who were getting tired of living in Sodom and Gomorrah. But Islam showed its hand by killing 2,000 innocent non-combatants on 9/11, and Islam lost all moral authority as a religion. In the providence of God, the religion of Islam is now dying. The J6 prisoners, by sitting in prison, must realize that they're doing more for their country and the cause of righteousness than if they had never been arrested in the first place. Yes, it's a life disruption. It's uncomfortable, but they must know that by their imprisonment, they are still continuing their protest against Washington corruption. A protest that authorities don't see or understand, but one that is far more effective than just that one-day rally on January 6th. History will vindicate these J6 prisoners and teach a valuable lesson about government corruption for ages to come. Now, I'm not talking about that very small group of those who broke windows and doors, but those who are standing up for honest elections. Another good outcome from the January 6th arrest is that it has become God's warning to his people not to engage in violence in future protests. And to watch out for opposition plants in the crowd. The bad actors, the plants on January 6th meant it for evil, to discredit the conservative movement, but God meant it for good. Because the whole event likely is preventing the real possibility of violence at future conservative rallies. And furthermore, think about this. The left's reaction to January 6th is going to come back to haunt them. Because what can they do someday when there's an election outcome that they don't like? One in which they believe the election was stolen. They have already set up a precedent that they have to accept election results without protest. They can't do sit-ins, break-ins, disruptions like the left did in the 1960s. The left is on record saying that anyone who disagrees with the results and breaks the law is a domestic terrorist and must be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. They can't complain if their protesters have to sit in jail without bail. Now you say, well, the left is not going to care. They're still going to practice a double standard. Well, sure, but common sense people will not be as fooled by their justifications. So the point I'm making is that God has some very good reasons why he lets his people be led as sheep to the slaughter. That's Psalm 44:22. That's also, again, quoted in Romans chapter 8, verse 36, because it's such a part of the Christian life. Being persecuted for righteousness' sake, by being in prison, we are establishing a testimony for God. We're exposing the evil of this world, the evil of those who hate God and his law. And this testimony draws into the kingdom the meek of this world who are seeking to be part of those who are of the truth. Our persecution is God's megaphone to this world. This is why the administration of Elijah is not normative. God only sends fire upon the enemies of the Lord to establish that he's able to judge the wicked at any time. But in most cases, God wants to show the evil of the world against his people, and God wants to show the faith of his people. And that brings me to the next truth. Part of God's plan is to test our faith, to give us the opportunity to stand for God even if it means our very lives. It's 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. When we're persecuted for righteousness' sake, it has a sanctifying effect upon us. Our priorities are set straight, and we're tested by God, and we're building up for ourselves rewards in heaven. Persecution is God's way to reward us, Matthew chapter 5, verse 10. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. I was recently listening to a piece by Andrew Clavin about how conservatives need to have a moral vision because the left has a moral vision. It's a wrong moral vision, but they have a moral vision. So the right also needs to communicate the end goal, the reason for our cause. Proverbs 29:18, where there is no vision, the people perish. And there are some conservatives who put forth the moral vision that the goal of the conservative movement is to save America. But that is not the moral vision I'm trying to communicate to God's people. Our moral vision is Revelation chapter 12, verse 11. And they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives, even when faced with death. That's how we win. By standing for the truth, regardless of the consequences. And by this, Satan and his people are defeated. Because the only way Satan wins, if we sell God out for our comfort and safety. Our goal and the purpose is to stand for God in his truth, and then God will destroy evil for us, supernaturally. This is a truth I find that Christians take a few years to comprehend and embrace. That we're to pick up our cross and to follow Jesus to the cross. Well, the final truth I want to share is that God defeats evil for us. Even though it doesn't seem like we have the authority to call down fire from heaven, when we're persecuted, God has already passed judgment in our favor, just as if fire has come down from heaven. When Herod killed James, a short while later in the same chapter, Herod was struck with the disease and died. Shortly after the high priest hung Jeremiah in a pit, the Babylonians invaded the city, and we read in Jeremiah 52 that the king of Babylon cut the high priest down with a sword. Paul didn't have to pray for judgment upon those who arrested him, because in a few years, Jerusalem would be surrounded by the Roman army and all of the leadership would be slain. The judgments of God are already passed upon the persecutors of God's people. The clock is set. It's ticking. The short time the persecutors of God's people have to live is the time between the verdict in the courtroom and the march to the gallows. And this was Jonathan Edwards' sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, based upon Deuteronomy 32:35. Vengeance is mine and retribution. In due time, their foot will slip, for the day of their calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them. The unsaved, the wicked, are being held over hell by a thread. You may want to reread that sermon again. Have you seen recently what has happened to Andrew Cuomo and his brother Chris? What has happened to Zucker, the head of CNN? The divorce and the family breakup of Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos? Have you seen recent pictures of Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, George Soros, their death warmed over? God will save his people. Psalm 37:28, for the Lord loves justice and does not forsake his godly ones. They are preserved forever, but the descendants of the wicked will be cut off. So thanks for listening. You can help this channel at YouTube and Rumble by subscribing, sharing, liking, leaving a comment below, and may Jesus Christ reign.